What's happening, people, and welcome to this month's episode of the Football Fans Podcast, The Shootout. You know how we do by now on The Shootout. We invite a former football player to come on the pod and we have a bit more of a detailed discussion around football, and we do a little bit more digging into that individual's career on a one-to-one basis. This month on The Shootout, I'm really excited because we've got a guy on who I've got a huge respect for, and I'm really glad that he's joining us on this week's pod. I want to welcome to the pod former Burnley, QPR, Blackpool centre-back, Mr. Clark Carlisle. Clark, how are you doing, my friend?
Oh, exceptionally well, thank you, Jordan. I'm glad you didn't go through all the clubs. That would have taken up the whole podcast.
I thought about it, but you know what? Let me just stop at three. Three's a good number to stop at. I thought I'd end it there. Listen, Clark, let's get straight into it. I want to talk to you about so many things, and I won't take up your whole day. But let me start off by asking you something that I ask a lot of former players that I speak to. Do you miss football? And you've been retired now a little while. And the reason why I ask that is because a lot of players talk about when they retire, they really struggle in replacing that enjoyment, that high, that routine, that buzz that they got from playing for 10, 15, 20 years. Or are you one of those players that actually, you know, you loved the game and you loved football, but your new life post-football, you've replaced it with something that you equally find enjoyable?
Wow. Do you know, that's a huge question, Jordan, because on any given day, I could give you a very different answer. There are certain times when I miss football to the core of my being. And usually that comes with certain times of year. And I'll say the one that stands out the most, which might surprise a few, it's not, you know, when the trophies are being handed out and all the rest of it. That's not it. The biggest day of the year where I really pang for football is the first day of the season. The first day of a new season, it doesn't matter which club you're at. It doesn't matter what division you're in. It doesn't matter where your match is. You've got however many thousands of people in the stand who've been starved of football for 2 months. You've got a squad that's been training hard for 2 months, getting themselves as fit as possible, as technically and tactically astute as possible. And it's the first day of the season. It's usually baking hot and anything is possible. And you walk out of that tunnel and the roar that greets you from all fans, that hope, expectation is incredible. It's like, oh, I've worked for this moment right now. So then you're 3-0 down after 2 minutes and you kind of like, all right. No, but that moment, mate, is absolutely incredible.
So this. Go on. Sorry, I was cutting you off there.
There are wider issues around it, though, Jordan. You know, that's a specific moment where you're after that adrenaline rush. You know, that big hit of serotonin. But there are bigger things around it. So you mentioned there the routine. You know, you've been in an industry where for 15, 16, 17 years, you've been told when to get up, what to eat, what to wear, where to be, when to be there, who to talk to when you get there, who to not talk to, what to say, how to say it, what to do when you get there, when to go to bed. And that's 24/7 London. London does dominate your life. No, football dominates your life. And then all of a sudden, mate, overnight, it's gone. It's totally and utterly gone. That structure, that strict, disciplined, objective, driven life is gone. And there's no focus. There's no drive. There's no, you know, for guys who have been totally dictated to since they left school. So you come from your home where you've been dictated to by your parents or guardians into an industry where you are dictated to a greater degree, because the outcome of your choices actually defines the course of your livelihood and your career. And then all of a sudden it's gone and you're just left floundering, mate. So there's a huge gaping hole in your life. And even though I studied for a degree and I had a new career lined up. I went into broadcasting, but it still doesn't fill that void of direction and goal-driven life where the consequences are daily. You know, so yeah, it's a huge issue. And you know what? It goes even further, mate, because there are days where I am absolutely delighted to not be playing football. I wake up now, most mornings, I had a whole reconstruction on my right knee. Both knees are arthritic, both ankles are arthritic, and both ankles have got floating bones in. So on any given day, I'll wake up with three of my four leg joints in utter turmoil. You know, my ankles lock sporadically. I'm trying to play with the kids and I'm falling over and I have to take a breather. I'm like, bloody hell, I'm not even 40, you know, and my body's in turmoil. There'll be another day where I'm walking down the ninth fairway, Ashton and Leah, where I now play golf, and directly over the river is Preston North End's training ground. And I watch those lads running around the track, blowing out on their backsides, and I'm like, I'm delighted that I'm stood here with a 7-iron in my hand looking at you instead of running around the track looking at guys playing golf. So it really does vary from day to day, mate. It's not a simple yes or no answer.
It differs. And at this stage of the calendar year when you were playing, were you quite glad that you had some downtime to recover and chill from the season you just finished, or were you really anxious about getting into the, as you mentioned earlier on, the first game of the season and the season that would have been approaching? How did you deal with this part of the year?
This time of year, where are we? We're in the middle of June.
Yeah.
So it'll just be the end of your break. Like you'd probably be starting a pre-season yourself. Because gone are the days where you could go and have a 6-week holiday, get tanked up, just eat steak and cheese and then come back and try and sweat it all out in pre-season. You know, the guys nowadays, even more so than when I was playing, which was only 6 years ago, they are complete and utter athletes. From, you know, I remember when you could tell a guy's position from his body type, you know, from his somatotype. If he was big and heavy, it was kind of likely he was a centre-half. If he was little and slight, then he'd be a winger or a full-back, you know. That's gone, mate. Footballers are complete and utter mesomorphs, and they are athletes from goalkeeper all the way through to striker. It's utterly incredible. So now the guys love to switch off in the summer. You need it. It is of paramount importance that for your mind, you allow yourself to take that break from football, because it is all consuming. But you can't totally switch off. You know, you might be able to have 2 weeks where you can have a few pizzas and you go out and have a steak in that. But then from there, you've got to start getting your body in peak condition again. So when I was playing, I loved the break. I really did, because like the season needed to be put behind. And sometimes, you know, there was some psychological work that needed to be done. If you've been relegated, your whole identity and self-worth has been questioned, and you've actually been categorized as the worst in that league. Mate, that's horrible. It's a horrible thought to go away with for 6 weeks that you are the worst. You know, you have to psychologically overcome that and rebuild yourself to be able to come back to a new season and feel positive about yourself and feel that you are worthy of a position in a squad, in a league, in an industry. So, you know, there's a lot of work that needs to go on there. And conversely, but very similarly, if you get promoted, you're kind of like, that was awesome. You ride the celebration. And then the self-doubt kicks in. You're kind of like, oh, wow, we're stepping up a level now. You know, I know we did well last season, but are we good enough? Am I good enough to make this step up? Who's the gaffer going to buy in the off season? You know, who's he going to bring in? Who he thinks does have the quality that he might think is better than me?
So for you, Clark, sorry to cut you there. So for you, so the teams that have just been promoted, for example, to the Premier League, do you think that doubt of are we good enough to be amongst the Agüeros and the Salahs and the Aubameyangs, does that trump the excitement of bouncing into the new season of we're champions from the division below?
It fluctuates from day to day, fella. It fluctuates. The days when you're feeling good are probably the days when you're in and around the club and you're with the guys who you were with all through last season, you know, and you have that camaraderie and that buoyancy. And the days when you doubt yourself are when you're sat at home watching Sky Sports News and it says your club has just broke their transfer fee for a player in your position.
Okay.
You know, okay. And you're like, oh, wow, who's this guy?
Yeah.
Do you know what? Permission to speak freely, sir.
No, go
do you know
it.
What happens as well, Jordan, is you've got a contract. I'll give you an example, and I'll put a value on it. When I was at Watford, I was on £3,500 a week when we got promoted, and I had no clause in my contract that went up if we got promoted. Because we were relegation favourites when I signed, you know, it was a pipe dream. We got promoted, my salary stayed the same, and then a couple of guys come in, and you're thinking, oh, I wonder how much she's on. And then you hear the rumour that this guy's come in on 15, 16, 17,000 pounds a week, and you're like, oh my goodness, well, does that mean that I'm 20% of the player that he is? Then you go and have a word with the gaffer. You say, gaffer, I was part of the team that got us here into the Premier League. You know, do I get a reward for that? And the gaffer will be like, well, you got your promotion bonus, but now you've got to earn it again. So there's a really interesting dynamic where new players come in and there's almost an us and them. You know, there are the guys who got us there. And then you see these new players coming in, reaping the financial rewards of your hard work. And there can be a bit of resentment that kicks in, especially if they're straight into the side. And you're like, well, I earned this opportunity.
Do you think that happened at Fulham? It totally does. Do you think that's what happened at Fulham?
I can say hand on heart that it happens, whether in a small amount or a large amount, at every club that gets promoted. At every club, there will be a bit of buzz that kind of gains momentum as the new season unfolds and the new squad takes shape. But hopefully, you've got a manager who can bridge that gap. You've got a coaching setup of people who have one foot in either camp, who can, you know, really console those who feel left behind, but also. The relative superstars who come in, who can actually still hold them in contact with the players who were there before.
Indeed. I want to get back to you in just a second, but you mentioned something when you're talking about the contracts there that kind of triggered a question in my head. This is obviously the season for transfer speculation and all the in-goings and outgoings, and there's a lot of talk about who may go where and all that kind of stuff. And I always wondered to myself, how much do the players in the dressing room talk about who's getting what and who might be leaving, who might be coming in? From the outside, we don't know what's being said and what's being thought. But inside the dressing room, so for example, at Manchester United, there's obviously a lot of talk at the moment of Paul Pogba potentially leaving or wanting to leave to go to another club. By the time this comes out, he may have gone, so it could be redundant. But would you imagine that in that dressing room, there's a lot of talk about, oh, is he going to go? Does he think, you know, he's better than us? We've got to keep him at all costs. Is there a lot of talk amongst players? Is there as much noise in the dressing room as there is amongst the fan base and the media on the outside, is what I'm asking?
No, nowhere near. Nowhere near, because football is very much a self-preservation society. Even though you're within a squad, your stock and your investment is in yourself. Now, you talk about do players discuss their salary? I would say there's almost an omerta about your own salary, but players will, in groups, discuss other players' salaries. Oh, you can bet your bottom dollar. Yeah. And especially, like I said, if there is a disparity, you know, there'll be a little discussion about how on earth is this guy pulling in this dollar when I don't think he's very good. You know, does that? I hope that makes sense. But
not totally.
At a club like Manchester United, mate, I would very much doubt that the difference between, you know, £240,000 a week and £180,000 a week is discussed, even though it's a gargantuan gap for us sat here discussing it. At that level, I don't think it will be as discussed as at, let's say, when I was at Northampton Town and you've got a guy on £600 a week and a guy on £1,600 a week.
Okay, I see. Admit that. Okay, so back to you now. So what are you up to? Because you mentioned it's been 6 years since you've retired now. We went into broadcasting and a little bit of punditry for a while. And we've not seen you for a while. What's Clark Carlisle up to at the moment?
Yes, Clark Carlisle is now not only happily married, but he is working with his hopefully happily married wife. And we go up and down the country, corporate speaking. We go and talk about our experiences in the mental health arena, share our experiences and our learnings, and hopefully give you know, little nuggets of advice to those who are joining us on this curve of being totally cognizant of their mental health journey. You know, we're noticing a huge ascendancy in people's appetite to discuss their mental health journey. And what we found, Jordan, especially through personal experience, is being reactive on this and doing something when you're in crisis, or like my case, in absolute disaster recovery. It's too late. It's too late, fella. You know, that there are literally hundreds of people dying each week because they're reacting, and the whole notion of their mental health is crisis management. Mate, we don't do that with our physical health. You know, you talk to someone about their physical health and their immediate response is, oh, well, I'm on this diet, I do this exercise, you know, I'm doing this during the day. That's not physical illness. That's actually maintenance of physical health. Now, we need to take that approach to our mental health. So when I say that word or those words to you, you're not thinking depression, anxiety, psychotic, you know, suicide. You're thinking, yeah, well, do you know what I do actually? I do a touch of meditation, or I take some quality time out for me, or I make sure that my work-life balance is in check, or I am emotionally aware. And when things are too much for me, I have a couple of counseling sessions so that I get professional guidance to lead me through this. And I use an analogy when I go speaking, and I think this should resonate with everyone, because everyone knows someone. I've got a guy who I play golf with, and his locker at golf, mate, is full of the most inane tat you've ever seen. Honestly, it's ram full. And every time he opens it, I'm looking at it, I'm thinking, what a load of junk. I asked him one day, I said, Stu, why have you got all of that tat in your locker? And he said, Clark, it's better that I'm looking at it than I'm looking for it when I need it. And I was like, wow, mate, that is. If we took that approach to our emotional and mental, psychological well-being, mm-hmm. mate, when a crisis, when a trauma, when something that was just, you know, just a slight knock, you know, like in football, being dropped from the team, mm-hmm. like at work, not getting that promotion, like a relationship breakup. When something like that comes into our life, we've actually got the support mechanism and the help that we need on hand, instead of floundering for 2, 3, 4 weeks, months, and having to react when it becomes a crisis.
I hear that. That does make sense. And you've been very open, Clark, about your mental health issues over the years. Do you feel like football is one of the few industries, or even the worst industry or job to do, especially the high profile that comes with it? Is it the worst job you can do if you are having some mental health issues because it's so public? Because it, there are worse ones.
No, mate. It doesn't matter what line of work you're in. It doesn't matter where in the world you live. Every job has its own individual stresses. Every job. Now, just because the stresses for you as a presenter are different to what mine were as a footballer, it doesn't make any one worse or easier than the other. Everything is relative to an individual's life. So if you're a single parent, if you're a doctor or a nurse, if you're a footballer, if you're a TV presenter, if you're unemployed, it's irrelevant. It's what your perspective of your situation is and whether you're viewing it with a clear, healthy, resilient mind or whether you're viewing it clouded with a chemical imbalance that's giving you a depressive outlook or an anxious outlook or any of the other spectrum of illnesses. Now, there are some very specific stresses in football, and they're very, very similar to all elite athletes. They're also very similar to what we now call a celebrity lifestyle and a celebrity culture, in as much as because of the technological age, your life's not your own, mate. You have 24/7 intrusion in your life from those externally. And not only is it intrusion, but they judge you. You are judged. You're not only judged on your professional performance, which you expect, but your professional performance is judged by your teammates, your manager, the fans, the pundits, the newspapers. Everyone has an opinion on your performance. And if you're anchoring your self-esteem on other people's judgments, that's gonna cause problems. Not only that, what you wear is going to be judged. What on earth has that got to do with my professional life? What you drive is going to be judged. How you speak in interviews is ridiculously judged. This really does my nuts in, Jordan, because you take a guy at the end of 90 minutes football when he's given his physical all to be successful, given his best, and then you expect him to stand up there and be erudite? Mate, not only is he knackered physically, psychologically, and mentally, but also football's been played for 150 years. There's a finite amount of things that you can say. You won, you lost, you drew. It was your fault. It was someone else's fault. You know, so everyone's like, oh, they're so boring. But then if someone has the audacity to say something out of the norm, then people are like, who the hell does this guy think he is? Yeah. Who's Joey Barton with an opinion? Who the heck is Ian Holloway think he can have a joke? You know, you're damned if you do and you're damned if you don't. And I think it's ludicrous. So then you take it one step further. You have a bad game. Your team loses at the weekend. You go home and you go out for your wife's birthday for a meal. And then you get a fan at the next table. Look at you laughing and smiling. We lost at the weekend. Does it not mean anything to you? Not only that, have they had direct input into you, they put it on social media. Look at this kid relaxing. Who does he think he is? Yeah. He should be doing this. He should be doing that. Right, people, there's an illusion of ownership in football that's horrible. You know, fans believe they have an ownership of a player, and that the way that they take it is that they then have the right to vent any and every feeling that they have directly to that player or through social media. Factor that out one, Jordan. If I go into Tesco and the shelves are messy, I don't stand there with the person working in Tesco and say, you're rubbish at your job. Yeah. Who do you think you are? Mm-hmm. What have you been doing all day? Mm-hmm. You know, I come in here to do my shopping. Mm-hmm. And look at this, it's sloppy. And then I don't go out on social media and say, oh, this guy in Tesco, you should have seen his hair. He was smiling and shells were sloppy. It doesn't happen like that. Just because I choose to put my money into that business, it doesn't give me any ownership over the people who work there. And that's the difference. Because football fans are fanatical, they take their judgments and their opinions a step too far, in my opinion.
And is that something that you always thought when you were playing and you might have been criticised? Or is this something since you've stopped playing, you've reflected on and thought, this is wrong and we're getting this the wrong way around? Or was this something even when you were playing that you clocked was going on and was wrong? Or is this something that you kind of, looking back on the game, have thought, hang on a minute, the way we're judging and analysing these...
It's something you always know when you're playing, but there are two parts about it. One, it is what it is. You know, you can't change what football is. That is the scenario. And, you know, let's not beat about the bush. You get recompensed for all that comes with the industry. So you have to deal with it that way. Secondly, you don't want to be the one who speaks out, because then you're seen as a troublemaker, you're seen as someone who rocks the boat, you're seen as, you know what, he's a decent player, but look at all this stuff that comes with him. You know, do we want that at our football club? So you don't want to be the one who singles yourself out for anything other than your footballing prowess. Because it's, Jordan, it's my livelihood. It's these guys' livelihoods. You know, the average career span is 7 years. You've given everything from nowadays, from age 5, to get into that industry. You've managed to be one of the 1% that get a pro contract. You've managed to be one of the 0.1% who are still in the game at 21. And then you've got maybe 7 years to earn to earn possibly a lifetime's income if you haven't got any kind of second career. You're not going to risk that or jeopardize it, you know, to speak out about A, B and C.
It's funny because the last 5 minutes you've been talking, all of the things you've been mentioning have got one football player in my head, and that's Paul Pogba. It's Paul Pogba, and it's someone that we talk about a lot on this podcast. And I'm going to admit, a lot of the listeners will realise and will know, I've been a critic of Paul Pogba as a player, and I think that there are elements to his game that a lot of United fans, a lot of Paul Pogba supporters, let him get away with. However, where I have defended Paul Pogba is in line with many of the things that you've been talking about. His haircuts, his personality, how he conducts himself, how he's judged off the pitch, and that kind of blurring of the lines of, because we pay for our tickets to watch Manchester United, we have a right to be intrusive and to criticise Paul Pogba for everything he does. And his mental health from the outside must be very, very strong to deal with all of the criticism that he receives off the pitch, and still smile, still be speak well, still conduct himself in a way that's very, very professional. And I wonder if he does leave Manchester United, that will be the reason why he leaves, because he's fed up of having every element of his life scrutinised and at times unfairly. Do you think that could play a role in why?
It'll be a contributory factor, Jordan, no doubt about it. But if it's the main reason, then he might as well retire. You know, this guy is better than the 0.1%. When you're talking about someone like Paul Pogba, you're talking about the 0.001%. This guy is the top of the tree. He's going to get that. He's going to get it. And that's a reflection of society, not just the industry. You know, what you're talking about there, mate, I think you're talking about a totally different issue. It's something that needs to be discussed. How do we express ourselves as individuals? Now, as much as we want to be totally inclusive, we need to understand that Paul Pogba, a second-generation African European, he expresses himself through dance. He expresses himself through the way he cuts his hair. He expresses himself in these ways which culturally are not acceptable. They're expected, and it's awesome. Yet we don't have the what's the word I'm looking for? We don't have a media, and definitely don't have a fan base with a voice who is analysing his actions through that lens. You can bet your bottom dollar that there is a strong African community, there's a strong black community who look at what Paul Pogba's doing with his hair, looking at what Paul Pogba's doing with his celebrations, looking at what Paul Pogba's doing, you know, with his mannerisms and the way he conducts himself, and say, there's a superstar.
Mm-hmm. Yet
the majority will be analysing it through a very, very different lens.
Completely agree. I think that lack of understanding of who he is and he does what he does
exactly.
is the reason why so many people are critical of him for reasons beyond giving the ball away or beyond hanging on to the ball for too long. They blur that line of, well, he played poorly because he spent too much time doing his hair. If he focused less on dance celebrations, but hang on a minute, that's who he is. And that's the guy you've got. If you embrace that, you might just have a better player. But I'm totally with you there. I'm totally with you there. I think that the surroundings around him, i.e. the media and the fan base, it's that lack of understanding that I think he just thought, you know what? I don't need this. I don't need this. Do you know what I mean? This is not fun for me. Do you know what I mean? This isn't enjoyable for me. So plus I'm at a team that's not doing well anyway. I'm going to move on. Just on the mental health thing as well, do you think football is still failing to deal with this issue? Because I'm doing a documentary at the moment, and an element of it is looking into, and something we discuss a lot on my podcast as well, is that too many clubs don't have, I don't know what you would call these people, but people that understand and talk to footballers to ensure that their mental health and their happiness is of the optimum in order to be able to perform and train to their optimum. Not enough clubs, I feel, have these individuals that are just there to just understand people's mindsets. I don't know if you'd call them doctors or just, I don't know what you would call them, but do you feel football and football clubs are still failing in this particular area of the industry?
Emphatically, yes, they are failing for a number of reasons. First of all, exactly what you said, you know, football thinks it's ahead of the curve because it's had psychologists in football clubs for, you know, for a couple of decades now. These are optimum performance psychologists. These are the guys who are coaching players to totally dismiss fear, to totally dismiss sadness or anger, to make sure that they can be blinkered enough to be an elite athlete. Now, don't get me wrong, that's necessary when you're in the footballing arena. What football doesn't do enough of is support, train, and coach these players to be whole human beings. So to be able to, once they leave the football club, set aside that working persona and develop themselves as a father, as a mother, as a brother, as a son, and understand that what they're doing with their emotions on the pitch in order to be totally focused and to be able to perform to the best of their ability is the total opposite of what they need to do in life to be able to develop as an emotionally capable human being. They are two very, very different things. So another reason why football is failing is because in England alone, it's not football. We say football and we use that as an overarching term. These are 92 separate entities. 92 separate entities that have three different governing bodies and a players' union, all fighting over ownership of doing something positive within the industry. Because of that, there is no uniform approach that ensures that this guy at Accrington Stanley gets exactly the same help, support, direction, treatment as this guy at Arsenal. So you can, and this is causing a huge problem because let's say there is a club who is delivering fantastic things in this area, and I can name a couple, Everton, West Brom, Burnley, they're all doing really, really good things about the whole player approach. A player leaves that club because you're only there for 2.5 years on average. A player leaves that club and goes to, I'm not going to say, but let's say X club, and then they totally lose that support system. The only thing worse than not having a support system is having one and having it taken away. That's the only thing worse. It's better than guys live in blissful ignorance and just continue with their maladaptive coping mechanisms than having some support and then have it taken away, because then you feel let down and you feel doubly isolated. So I totally believe that football is failing. I believe there should be a system that is without the governing bodies, that is without the football club, that is independently financed by the entire industry from the TV monies taken out at source, so that there's no ownership contest, that the support individuals are put into every football club, the same number, the same qualification, with the same agenda and approach, so that everybody has a support system that they know they can go to that's confidential and will not feed back into the coaching and management system at the football club. Because that's one of the biggest restrictions on a player. You don't want to go to anyone at the club because you don't want any negative connotations feeding back to the manager, who feels you may not be right or ready or capable to deal with what's coming up. Also, Jordan, furthermore, this is a human being issue. So it's not that you take it out of the coaching system so that they're kept away from it. You take it out of the hands of the coaching system so that they can utilize it too. Richard Bevan's put a fantastic thing in place for the League Managers Association, and it's something that needs to be expanded.
Interesting. And when Danny Rose spoke out recently about the problems that he was going through for a few years, and he recently even talked about how he went to a club, or he went to a club where he was going to potentially be leaving Spurs to go to, and they asked him, you know, I can't remember the direct words, but they inferred that, you know, basically, are you okay now, or are you going to go crazy?
Yeah. Again?
And that was the reason that he was like, you know what, how did that make you feel when he said that? And as a follow-up question to that, what would have helped you when you were playing? What would have helped you be a more rounded individual so that you could have performed to an even better standard than you were doing on the pitch already?
Well, they're two massive questions.
No, sorry.
how I felt when Danny spoke out about his feelings and what was said to him, I felt sad. I laughed because I thought it was ridiculous, and I thought it was indicative of where we are as a society in our understanding of mental health issues. You know, the fact that Danny was struggling wasn't because he didn't have the capacity or capability to deal with life or perform. It was because he didn't have the support structure to manage the emotional situation. And if he did have that, it would make him an even better footballer. And this is what people need to understand as human beings. You know, it's not that people don't have the capacity to deal with what's going on at work. It's incredible that they are dealing with what's going on at work in spite of going along with this illness. If you see someone coming into work with a cast on the leg and they're hobbling around doing their duties, you say, oh, look at that guy, he's a Trojan. Look at that woman, she's a Trojan. Still at work, you know, cracking on through the barrier. But if it's a psychological or emotional issue, then they're like, oh, what's up with this guy? What's up with this girl? Oh, they're just trying to, you know, jack off and get a bit of time. They just need to pull themselves together. No, they too are grinding through an issue in order to perform at work. Now, if they had the right support, they would be an even better employee / human being. And that's what it made me think when Danny spoke out about his. If football clubs had an understanding that if they have an adequate, a commensurate support mechanism, they will have even better players and even more stable human beings when they go away from the football club. What was the follow-up question, Jordan? I forgot.
So, yeah, for you personally.
Oh, what would I need?
Yeah, what would have helped you?
What would have helped me, mate, was understanding where I was in life. You know, I've been emotionally retarded since I was a child. And by that, I'm going to, you know, back reference myself. You know, when I said earlier about the optimum performance, about totally dismissing fear and anxiety and all the rest of it. Well, the way that I was brought up, you know, quite typical Afro-Caribbean household, you don't speak unless you're spoken to. And what you're crying for, stop crying, else I'll give you something to cry about. You know, so we, in our household, we didn't express any emotions other than if you were happy. And that conditioned me to totally avoid and suppress anything that I considered a negative emotion, which was fear, sadness, anger. Now, there's no such thing as a negative emotion. The only negative thing is the way that we process our emotions and the way that we cope with them, you know, our coping mechanisms. Now, because of that, I came into an industry where I was very, very frightened. I was very scared. I was very nervous all the time. But you can't show that. And because I couldn't show it, I suppressed it. And whenever those feelings came up, I wanted to avoid them at all costs. Now, how do you avoid emotions? You do it by changing state. How do you change state? The first thing that I found that worked for me was alcohol. I found that when I got drunk, not only did these emotions go away, but to be quite honest, I didn't give two oops about them. And that made me feel good. So that I found that that worked for me. Now, that's not productive in life, mate, that every time you feel sadness or anger or fear that you go drinking. But it was a coping mechanism that I found that worked for me, but it was a destructive one. So what would have worked for me, mate, was for me to be emotionally aware, for me to understand that all emotions are valid and that if I sit and feel them, they're transient, they go away. And once they've gone away, I can then reflect and see what it was that made me feel that way and hopefully do something about it. But the way that I sit with them now is not by drinking. I'll sit with them by maybe just sitting with a loved one, maybe sitting with my wife. I might just go and play golf as a productive distraction. Do you know what? And I know it's probably not right for me to say this, but I might come in the back garden, have a pot of coffee and smoke a pipe. Not a crack pipe, mind. Just a little bit of cherry tobacco, something like that, you know? And it just gives me a moment to sit, reflect, be with this emotion, and then it'll pass. Now, if we can have an emotionally aware population, it's a fantastic starting block for people to be able to put productive and constructive coping mechanisms in place.
And just a final question on mental health, and I promise I'll move on. How bad was it for you at its worst? And again, as a follow-up question to that, there'll be people listening to this podcast that maybe have experienced similar things or experiencing difficulties with their mental health. What is the process for you going forward? Because I've been told by people that know more about this than me, you never really recover from it. It's a process. What for you is the process of going forward and dealing with it to ensure that you're the best father, husband, friend, son that you can be? Day by day, what's your process?
Right. At its worst, Jordan, I was living in ignorance, so I didn't know that there was something going on. But my coping mechanisms were just totally destructive. So I'd go on huge drinking benders, I'd go on huge gambling benders, I would engage in dangerous behaviour. And by that I mean driving late at night down the A1 at 2 in the morning, and I think, oh, can you imagine if I just swerved my car into this bridge? Or, oh, let's see how long I can drive with my eyes closed or the lights off. I would play computer games for days on end. I would sleep for days on end. And I mean stay in my bed. I don't mean like, you know, oh, just get up, pot around the house. I would stay in my bed for 2 and 3 days. Because I didn't know something was going on, I just thought I was an absolute numpty. I thought I was an idiot. But now I can see that they were my coping mechanisms. They were my way of trying to avoid thinking or feeling any of the emotions that I was thinking and feeling at the time. So at its worst, mate, those things weren't doing their job. My depression took such a grip that on 4 occasions, I believed that death was the best answer for all. And this is another misconception, is that it's a coward's way, it's an easy way out. If you get to a point in life where you believe that death is the answer, that it's best for all concerned in your life, it's a positive thing for them that you die, that is not a normal frame of mind. That is not looking through a well compass. My perspective was so distorted. And then furthermore, mate, to actually go through with it, to override the basic human instinct to survive is one of the most incredible things that I've ever done. I can't fathom it now. I've sat here, well, I can't even fathom it. So trying to kill myself is the worst that it ever got. What do I say to those who are going through? What's my process? Well, my process, the only reason I've made progress is because I've approached this in what I believe is the right way. It's called the biopsychosocial model. If you are ill, the majority of mental health illnesses, they are caused by a chemical imbalance in the brain. So no matter what you do, no, you can't talk someone around in this situation. You can't give them £1 million and make them feel better or anything else that might make someone who is in a good place feel better. You have to sort out the chemical imbalance first. So the biological is the medication. You have to take the medication so that the chemicals in your brain are balanced. It doesn't make you happy. It doesn't make you sad. It makes you see your situation clearly for what it is, instead of making a mountain out of a molehill, for want of a better phrase. You know, all you see around yourself is disaster when that's not the reality. So the meds give you clarity of vision. Then there's the psychological. The psychological aspect is you need qualified professional help to find out how and why you got to the place that you're in and how you are going to take steps to get out of there. Now, that in itself is a really tricky step, mate, because there are so many different types of talking therapy. You know, you need to see a consultant psychiatrist, and then you need to try CBT, you need to try CAT, you need to try all these different talking therapies to find what works for you as an individual. And what makes it even harder is that there are different approaches within each therapy. So there might be someone who asks questions of you. There might be someone who just sits and listens. You know, there might be someone who reflects what you've said to you. You need to find the therapist that works for you in each of these arenas. So if you go and try one and it doesn't work, don't think, oh, no, it didn't work for me. Cross that person off the list and say, right, I'm going to try the next one. Because you need to find what works for you. The social aspect is then, once you've got those two things in place, is looking at your life and seeing how your life has impacted your mental health. So what is it at work that is contributing to you being out of kilter? What is it in your home life that's contributing to you being out of kilter? And how can I manage those situations? So in my life, mate, because I came from crisis management, it was incredibly small steps. When I got home from psychiatric hospital, I had to set goals each day. And the first few goals were get out of bed before 3 p.m., have a shower, have something to eat. And once I ticked those goals off, that was my day done and I could relax, you know. And then I'd go to sleep and say, right, I'm going to do the same again tomorrow. And then after a few days, you know, I start to set further goals. You know what? Today I'm going to go to the shop. Today I'm going to do this. Today I'm going to do that. But I could only start to make these strides from the basis of that biopsychosocial model. Now, like I said earlier, I'm the most well that I've been in my life, mate. And I forward plan the situation. So I know that my wife and I have done 3 deliveries this week. That takes a lot out of us emotionally. It takes a lot out of me because there's a lot of reflection on really tough situations in our life. So we've made sure that the next 7 days are totally free. they're totally free and we're going to have some family time. I'm going to play some golf and I'm going to make sure that I recuperate in order to be able to give again. Not only that, I'll make sure that I'm cognizant of where I am today. You know, my wife will ask me, where are you today? And we have a 1 to 10 system. 1 is feeling suicidal, like I was in psychiatric hospital. And 10 isn't on top of the world. 10 is just, you know what? I'm good. You know, that's a realistic scale. And I'll say to her, you know, I'm a 7 today. Oh, why is that? I just feel a bit tired. We've got an 18-month-old baby. She was up in the night. I'm feeling a 7. But that's okay. You know, and then we'll ask again later in the day. And I'll say, you know what? I'm an 8 now. I feel rested through the day. And that's really important to me. Because when I'm poorly and I'm feeling a 2 out of 10, it feels to me as though that's it, my life's end, you know, this is going to be my life forever. But it's important for me to acknowledge that in the morning, I might feel a 4 out of 10, but by the afternoon, I might feel a 7. You know, life fluctuates. I don't strive for happiness anymore, Jordan. I strive for contentment. I'm very aware of where I am in life. I'm so grateful for the blessings that I've got, my wife and beautiful children. And just the fact that I'm breathing. So finally, what do I say to anyone who is going through, has been through what I have experienced? Mate, you don't have to be like me. You don't have to tell everybody. But it's imperative that you tell somebody. I can guarantee anyone who's experiencing anything that I've been through, the moment that you open your mouth and voice what's going on, the power of your destructive thoughts diminish immediately. From that point, you then need to engage with professional services. You have to, because we need to know what we're working with. If you're reluctant to do that, go online and do something called the Goldberg test. That's a depression test. Go to your GB and your GP, and they will go through a very simple depression and anxiety test, and they will give you a mark, a grade, you know, so you know exactly what you're working with. And then from there, the only advice I can give you is be brutally honest. There are many, many people I know who have whispered to me, you know, I've been where you are, or I am where you are, and nobody's here to help me. Well, I'm going to ask you, have you given someone the opportunity to help you? Because these illnesses, they isolate you. They force you to keep everything to yourself. And that's the total opposite of what you need to do in order to start your recovery. So I'm going to ask you, have you given someone the opportunity to help you? And are you doing everything in your power to get help?
That's really helpful. That's really helpful. Thanks for that. Just a couple more, and I'll let you go. I promise. And we'll get some we'll get some football questions in a minute. I promise. But you're Preston, born and raised. Is that correct?
Yes, it is. Yeah.
All right. Talk to me a little bit, Clark, about how difficult it was growing up in a household with a black father in that part of the country in that time and trying to get into football and become a footballer. How difficult, if indeed it was, what was it for you in your younger years growing up?
You know, we could do a whole podcast on this, mate. We really could. But the truth of the matter is that black father, white mother, dad had to be prepared to physically fight people to walk down the street with my mum. Late 70s, early 80s in the north of England. An incredible dynamic. You know, we were blissfully unaware of it as kids. I'm amazed at the job that our parents did. We didn't have 2 apronies to rub together, yet they raised us with manners and respect, you know, with an understanding of love and with an understanding of cleanliness and hygiene. And not only that, Jordan, you know, my dad, he played football himself. He had England trials, went to an England trial, scored a hat-trick, and I think his team won 3-1. They come away and 2 other guys were picked. And his coach and a coach of 2 other teams were absolutely up in arms. And the scouts there just said, oh, he's not what we're looking for at this moment in time. You know, that's ludicrous. My dad was fantastic in the local leagues in Preston and District, like loads of trophies, and he was my inspiration, mate. I wanted to be a footballer like my dad. How hard was it for me? Do you know it wasn't hard at all? And the reason why it wasn't hard at all is because, A, my parents did not instill in me any notion of my race or colour of my skin being a restriction. I had no knowledge or thought that me being a black kid was going to inhibit me in any way. And I think the freedom that that gave me, consciously and subconsciously, allowed me to feel like anything was possible. I didn't look for a restriction, I looked for opportunity. That's my personal experience. Not only that, my dad, being the player that he was in Preston, was scouted by a man called Fred O'Donoghue. Now, Fred was a scout for Preston and for Blackpool, for Blackburn and for Blackpool. And my dad broke his ankle, so he only ever played semi-pro. He played for Southport and that. But because Fred O'Donoghue had scouted my dad, he kept an eye out for my dad's offspring. So as soon as I started playing Sunday League football, Fred O'Donoghue was watching me. And I was immediately signed up to play at Blackburn Centre of Excellence. And I was in midfield then. And they took on David Dunn instead of me. How did that work out for him? Yeah, rubbish. And I went to Blackpool, where Fred had moved on. So I won kind of like a genetics lottery, really. You know, my old man had been scouted there. My family was subsequently on the scouts' radar. And because of that, I got an opportunity to get into a professional club very early in my football career. So there's the blessing. And I don't ever want to say that I was lucky. I was never lucky, Jordan. I was blessed with an opportunity, and then I grafted my nuts off to make sure that I took that opportunity.
And how do you feel, just kind of bringing us to the current day of issues in the current game around racism, which has been at its peak again, the season just gone. How do you feel, you say that we're failing with mental health in football, we're clearly failing with racism in football, but there seems to be an empowerment amongst a particular group of black football players to speak out against what, not only say what's happening, but suggest what they think needs to be done to kind of prevent this from happening in the future. Where do you stand, Clark, on the idea of walking off pitches, banning fans from a certain amount of games for coming to the home games if clubs aren't learning lessons? What's your perspective on how do we deal with this fight, and what do you think has brought it to the fore? Because I also hear a lot of people this season saying, oh, you know, I'm surprised, oh, I thought we got rid of that, it's like the bad old it's like the bad old days again. And I'm like, what, where really? Have you been living? Do you know what
exactly.
I mean?
Exactly, Jordan.
Do you know what I mean? What's your view on it?
Is this another podcast? My goodness, how long have we got? Mate, do you know, the ludicrous thing is that people did think it had gone away. That's the ludicrous thing. So I'm going to talk about this with the brutal honesty that I live my life.
Please.
Racism didn't go anywhere. Overt racism got suppressed. That's what happened. And it happened in that drive, in the drive for equality, in the drive for political correctness. What happened was that people's free speech, let's not beat about the bush, people's free speech about their views, which they may be bigoted and racist, but their free speech about it was totally suppressed. So it all went underground. And then we embark upon a technological era where everybody has a platform. So instead of people discussing these things in underground clubs and in certain pubs that have got certain flags outside, etc., 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 we now have very, very visible platforms for this minority of people to express seriously racist views, and also for those who hold maybe uneducated, those who support maybe... What's the word I'm looking for? Institutionalized conditioning. views. These are starting to be expressed where they can be viewed. So something that has previously been the norm, that certain jobs are for men, certain jobs are for white people, certain jobs are for black people, certain jobs are for Asian people, certain races or religions aren't fit for this job. They're starting to be aired in platforms that people can see. And not only that, in a platform where someone can take a snapshot and that statement can never go away. And it's like, oh my days. This is still here, and not only is it still here, but it's here in the upper echelons of the decision-making corridors of society. That's because it's not gone away, Jordan. That's because people have been conditioned in their growing up. You and I have been conditioned by what we've seen in TV, what we've seen in newspapers, by the examples that have been set for us in our growing up, so that subconsciously, when we left home at 16, at 18, we had a preconceived idea of who was eligible for what role. That means that our instinctive decision was probably biased, was probably discriminatory. Now, it's only when we start to think about our thinking, how did I automatically make that decision? That this black man here stood in a hotel foyer with a running Mercedes outside is not a chauffeur. How did I instinctively make the decision that he might be the car that's coming to pick me up? How did I instinctively make that decision that this guy stood here in a tracksuit is part of the coaching setup at this football club and is not just a random fan? I made it because of the images that have been sown in me growing up. Now it's time for us to totally break these images down. And we can only do that when the people who are making the decisions about who to put in these roles are questioning their decision-making too. When we talk about overt racism at football clubs, it's the same as overt racism in society. Jordan, it's never going away. I hate to be the breaker of bad news. This is a human being issue. If we are human beings, and if because we're human beings, there will always be us and them. It's tribal, it's natural, it's instinctive. And when there is nothing intellectual to separate up and us and them, we will take it to the basest possible level. So whether that be your religion, whether it be the color of your skin, whether it be the color of your hair, there will always be something visible that defines us and them. And as humans, we will resort to that when there's nothing else to intellectualize. It's not going away. What do we do about it in football? We ban people. I think you ban clubs, you kick them out of competitions because they'll do something about it. I think you ban fans and you charge them because this is a criminal offence. You put people in prison. If I committed any other criminal offence, if I stole something at football, I'd still be put in prison. If I racially abuse someone in the street, I'd still go to court. So why does it not happen in this mob mentality platform? Because we're still scared of it for some reason, because it's a capitalistic behemoth that has its own momentum and that has to be stopped.
And did you ever receive any racism when you were playing? And did you ever contemplate walking off the pitch?
No, I didn't contemplate walking off the pitch because it's a self-preservation society and I didn't have the balls to.
Interesting. Interesting. And just kind of a couple more and then I will let you go, I promise. You're what seems one of the few individuals from football in the last decade who's intellectual and smart and can speak well. I think you're one of only two footballers to have featured on Question Time, if I'm not mistaken. There, did having that kind of tag and that kind of credit put on your head? Did you embrace that and did you think, oh, you know, I like this. You know, I'm a smart guy. I can talk properly. I know a little bit about things beyond 4-4-2. Or did you find it almost quite patronising from people when that, if you felt this at all? Because I remember thinking at the time, you know, I wonder if Clark Carlisle feels like, yeah, I am an intelligent guy and I have something to say beyond football. Or whether you thought, you know, actually, just because I can put two words together, That doesn't mean that other footballers can't. I'm just one of the people that actually has had a platform to do so.
Well, the two perspectives you give there aren't mutually exclusive, mate. I found it incredibly patronising. First of all, people would say, oh, you're a footballer and you can talk, as though, you know, you can't have any semblance of intellect if you play football. Look, it's an aspirational vocation. It doesn't mean that people haven't got brains. It means that they've got a talent in an area and they've committed themselves to that as a career. I wasn't even the most intelligent person in any of my football clubs, never mind in football, Jordan. And I found it absolutely ludicrous that people would put that tag on me. But also, you know, I'm a big black guy with tattoos who always walked around in basketball vests and shorts. And people would look at me. And then when I said, oh, good afternoon, sir, they'd be like, huh? And they'd be taken aback. Now, these are people who haven't got a clue that I'm a footballer. But they're taken aback that this guy who has a certain image can be well-spoken and have manners. That's nothing to do with football. That's to do with the racial stereotyping that we were talking about earlier.
I was
going
to say, that goes back to the conditioning you were talking about just before, yeah.
Exactly. So, but you put the two together, and if you're a young black tattooed footballer, then people expect you to be an absolute numpty. Now, it is ludicrous. But don't get me wrong, I embraced it. Do you know why I embraced it? Because it gave me an advantage over every room that I walked into. People's expectations of me were at a certain level, and as soon as I opened my mouth, I totally blew that level away. I was always onto a winner. So yeah, I embraced it. And do you know what? Self-preservation society, you're damn right I ran with it. I ran with it because it opened doors for me that... 99% of other black footballers didn't have open to them. I sincerely hope that I've left that door open behind me. But look, Jordan, it was a ridiculous situation, but it's a situation that is, and there's nothing that I could do about it. So I took it and made it to my advantage.
I tried to find, look to your record, Clark. I tried to find some goals that you scored throughout your career. And I'm not going to lie, I struggled to find many. But what was the best goal that you scored? What was the most enjoyable goal you scored during your professional career?
What did you say? Did I hear you correctly? Did you say that you tried to find goals for my career?
I found a few.
Oh, mate! Of all the things we talk about, you've just turned to it. No, mate, I was a defender. You know, I stopped him. I didn't score him. But I think I averaged about 5 a season, didn't I? Which ain't bad. You know, 50-odd goals for a centre-half ain't bad. My favourite goal... without doubt, was my overhead kick for Burnley away at Bristol City.
Yeah, I found that.
Oh, yeah, that was incredible because it was the first game that I ever wore white boots. And I remember Steve Cotswold saying, you need to be a bit special to wear white boots. Need to be a bit special to wear white boots as a centre-half. And then I scored an overhead kick. Yeah, it was from 7 yards. I don't care. It was a kick. It was a bicycle attack. Pele. And yeah, that was a bit special, that mate. I think I still got it on Betamax.
I'm sure you do. How much are you looking forward to the new Premier League season? Because off the back of a very tight title race last year between Liverpool and Manchester City, you know, I think Liverpool will go again. I think City will go again. Not only how much are you looking forward to it, but how much would you attribute the standard of those two teams, and Tottenham to a lesser degree, to the managers that have had time to work on those teams to sculpture two fantastic football teams that are two of the best now in Europe? Well, one is the best in Europe, but two of the best for sure in Europe.
They've done ever so well, you know, especially because football came through an intense period of immediate success required, immediate transformation required. And it seems like there have been people who have got the depth of pockets to be able to ride out a transition period to show faith in some incredible coaches and managers. It's a shame that all football clubs don't take that approach. But because it is a business and a capitalistic behemoth, like we said earlier, you know, not all clubs can afford to take that approach. But if you look at a club like Burnley, you look at some of the clubs who have just been Premier League mainstays, you know, for 10 or dozen years, you know, these are clubs that can forge hopefully a prosperous future, as long as they manage their expectations. I think a classic example is Leicester. You know, you win the Premier League, which is just, it's absolutely ludicrous that they did it. It was one of the best things that I have seen in my footballing life. And then halfway through the season later, they get rid of a manager because their expectation has shifted to unreasonable. You know, people need to maintain their expectation and keep it relative to what their means are within the Premier League. Look at Liverpool, look at Manchester City. There is no doubt that the two factors are incredible managers / coaches and a huge, huge pot of money. What it's done is made football incredibly more aesthetically pleasing. It had, until last year, made football incredibly dull, because it's a lovely spectacle, but you knew what was going to happen. Man City were going to dominate games, batter teams, win the league by 15 points. It's awesome to see Liverpool up there. Hopefully Tottenham will be up there. How much am I looking forward to next season? Couldn't give two oops, if I'm honest, Jordan. No, that's my truth. I couldn't give two oops. I'll watch the big games because it's nice. You talk about goals. Goals didn't mean much to me. They didn't mean as much as the tackle I put in on Lamano Luwalewa on the halfway line at Vicarage Road. I ran towards him from 23 yards, full pace. He didn't look over his shoulder. That's a schoolboy error when Clark's on the pitch. Absolutely lifted him. And it's a tackle that I get sent off for three times today. That was real football, mate, and that's what I miss.
Indeed. And just final question. I ask all my guests this question to kind of wrap up with. If there was one thing that you could change about the game, about football, anything you could change to make it better, what would the one thing you would change? One thing you would, do to change.
What a really good question. What would I change to make it better? Ooh.
Yeah, I put you on the spot there. I appreciate
you have put me on the spot, and I can't think of anything that would immediately make it better. I can think of something that might make it fairer.
Okay, go on.
And that would be, instead of having financial fair play, just have everybody has the same budget. Can you imagine that? So every season you start with £50 million and you're allowed to, and you have X million pounds to spend on wages. Right. Let's see what happens. Just level the financial playing field across the board in each league and have it tiered. And that's when you would see who's the best manager. That's when you'd see who's the best coach.
I think that's not a bad idea at all. Clark Carlisle, thank you very much for your time and your honesty. It's really, really good for me to hear you be so open and honest about your experiences in the game, your experiences personally. And like I said at the start, you're one of the few people in the game that I do have a lot of respect for, because you're so honest and open, and I do respect honesty when people speak out and speak to me as well. So I really appreciate your time, and I wish you all the best. I wish you all the best in health. Going forward, all the work you're doing with the speaking engagements you're doing and the foundation you've got. Do you want to plug your foundation quickly as well? Just anybody?
No, I don't at all. It will do its own stuff, mate. Cool. It will do its own stuff. It's not one of these things that we push front and centre. It's doing its work in the background, and we're very proud of it. But Jordan, thank you so much for your time, mate.
No, thank you too, mate.
It's always a pleasure to speak to someone who has insightful questions.
Thank you very much. I appreciate that too. Thank you. All the best, sir.
God bless you, mate.
Take care.